Hey, it's that time again.
Seriously? Awesome.
Yes.
All right.
We're watching number 91 on the AFI Top 100 Movies of All Time 10th Anniversary Edition. Sophie's Choice.
You know, full disclosure, I very honestly thought this movie was about abortion. I really did.
Well, it kind of is. But not how you might think.
Oh, I'm excited.
Yeah.
I think they might have said it at some point in a news segment, or some comedian made a joke, but for some reason in my mind, I thought Sophie's Choice was about her getting an abortion.
Yeah. No.
No?
No, not in the traditional sense, no.
Oh.
Yeah.
Gross.
All right, so okay. Everybody who's listening now has got to know that if you've listened all the way through all the podcasts that we're doing, and we're on, what is this, number 10. Wow.
10 of these.
We are finishing our first decade.
Woo! Yay!
Sweet. Okay, so everybody knows how this works, so there will be spoilers.
Oh, yeah.
So if you haven't seen Sophie's Choice and you want to see it, before we wreck it for you. I mean, after all, it did come out 30 years ago in 1982.
I think we can spoil a 30-year-old movie.
I'm pretty sure, yeah. But you never know. There might be, hey, stop it. I've been saving that one for when I was 90 or something like that, you know.
Right, okay.
That's a, I don't know, a 60. I don't know what that is. I don't know what that was. Anyway.
So we gonna watch this movie
now? We're going to spoil it like crazy, so, the feel-good hit of 1982.
Oh, it's a feel-good. Awesome.
Oh,
great.
Boy, is it ever a feel-good hit. Yes.
Great. I could use a good rom-com right about now.
Sophie's Choice will probably put you in the mood for one.
Awesome.
So, if you're going to watch with us, you should probably start now. And we're back.
Oh my God, you lied to me!
I did nothing of the sort. What was my lie?
You said it was a romantic comedy.
No, you said it was a romantic comedy. I just refrained from disagreeing with you. In fact, I believe that I said...
That's still lying, you bastard! Oh God, this movie. Why? This is just a sad movie just heaps with sad and more sad, and towards the end of it, it's just even more sad.
Mm-hmm.
It's just all sad.
Yeah.
And it just sad.
Yeah.
More sad and schizophrenia and sad.
It was all those things.
Yeah.
And so much more.
Gave me the feels, man.
I
had the feels. Oh, this movie.
And it didn't cop out at the end.
Nope.
And have a happy ending.
Nope. Which is probably why it's on the AFI list.
It might be.
Maybe.
At least it's why people remember it. And
yeah.
Why people don't say, you know, there you go.
Huh. All right, so this movie was sad, but it actually kind of started out a little bit optimistic. I mean, the way the movie started was, you know, it was the very basic story of boy comes to town.
Uh-huh.
And he, you know, moved into this apartment, moved into a room in a house that was all pink.
Yes.
Because the army surplus, because the
Navy surplus,
the Navy surplus, the
yeah.
The landlady had a dead husband who had purchased hundreds of thousands of gallons of surplus paint that was all hot pink. Apparently, they didn't need that much in the boats. And as the story progresses, he's left a book that has a note on it from the upstairs neighbors or a upstairs neighbor.
No, it's both of them.
Is it both
Sophie
of them?
And Nathan? Yeah.
Sophie and Nathan.
So the character that the Fro is referring to there is Stingo.
Stingo, yes, the main
played
character.
Played by Peter McNichol. He's the narrator. An older Stingo is the narrator.
Yes.
The younger Stingo doesn't narrate the show. He just serves as the lens for the audience.
Right.
And he's the guy that everybody confesses to.
Yeah.
He's the guy from which or through which we learn eventually what Sophie's choice is. Because there's a bunch of choices she makes.
Yeah.
A lot of them in this. It's not just the one.
No.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, there are a lot of them.
Granted, they all kind of pale by comparison.
Yeah.
Right there at the...
At the antithesis, the titular choice that she makes.
Yeah.
So this, and then as the, then moving on, he finally meets the couple, Nathan and Sophie,
And then
having an argument. He meets them through having an argument. They're having an argument.
And then they apologize, and they become, in Stingo's words, the best of friends.
Yes, it was the best of friends. It was apparently the worst of friends as well. Jesus Christ.
Wow.
Tale
of two friendships.
Through
a flashback, we learn about Sophie and Nathan's early relationship.
Yep.
About how they met cute.
Yes.
In the library when she fainted because of anemia.
Yeah.
And he brought her around.
Uh-huh.
And took her home and fed her liver and leeks.
Who apparently Nero ate all the time so it would deepen his voice. Does that work?
I don't think it does.
That'd be cool.
It could. I don't know.
That'd be cool. So after that,
So we learn of some of Sophie's... We learn of that. We learn of a little bit of her after-war experience. So this whole thing has taken place in the summer of 1947 in Brooklyn. And really, over the course of just a few weeks, I don't think there's months.
I think this is probably about a month and a half.
He does keep referring to that summer.
Yeah.
And having never seen them again, and et cetera, et cetera. The device used to show the strengthening of their friendship actually is another character named Leslie Lapidus, self-described in the terms of the 40s a self-proclaimed nymphomaniac with sex on the brain. Now, the reason I say this is what is used, the device that's used to show that their friendship is strengthening, is because Nathan introduces the two of them. This is how this relationship comes about. And Stingo has, in one of the few, I think, comedic moments of the film.
Oh God!
Although there were a few chucklers.
Yeah.
You know, to break the dramatic tension, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
He's introduced to this girl. He goes on a date with her. They never leave her parents' house or apartment.
Yeah, which.
But she is, as I said, a self-described nymphomaniac with sex on the brain, and she is talking about she's just all up in his business with the sex talk.
Yeah,
and about people fucking.
Yes.
And just getting it on.
Yeah.
And et cetera. Until he makes a move on her, she freaks out.
Yep.
Because her psychotherapy has only gone so far.
Oh, God.
She's able to vocalize.
But that doesn't
mean that she's going to do anything.
Yeah.
So, in the words of Stingo, Leslie Lapidus could say fuck, but she could not do it.
I think the deal breaker for me was the fact that they hit a phone underneath a doll. That was pretty fucking creepy.
It was a little creepy, wasn't it?
It was just like, ring, 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 lift up doll, and there's a phone underneath. It's like, ah, nope.
Nope. As a counterpoint to that, when Stingo goes back to the apartment, he is ushered upstairs by Sophie, who reveals to him another experience of Auschwitz, as actually her experience of being sent to Auschwitz. She has recently revealed that both her husband and her father were sent to Sachsenhausen. Where they were shot the next day.
Yeah.
So she talks about going to Auschwitz and losing her child, losing one of her children to the chamber, the gas chambers when they got there. And then another child is sent off to the Kinderlager.
Yeah.
Which is the children's camp. And she becomes a secretary for Rudolf Hess.
Yes.
Who was the commandant of Auschwitz.
The only real person in the whole movie.
Yeah, the only real person. There's a title card at the end that, that announces that Rudolf Hess is the only real person in the film.
Yeah.
And she, in another choice, decides to try to use herself as a bargaining chip to get her child out of the Kinderlager.
Yeah.
To get him freed from there, so that he can go and live in Germany.
As a little red, brown shirt, or
I
don't remember what they were
because
called.
Because he looks German, he could be raised as German.
Yeah, he
so
looks German.
So he's taken home.
Yeah,
the Lebensborn. So it's the interesting things. So far in this story, we didn't mention that Nathan is a chemist for Pfizer.
Yes,
and he is also a raging alcoholic.
Yes.
So the fight, I think, at the beginning when he's in, when Stingo is introduced to them, is more about them being drunk together and fighting, or him being drunk at any rate, Nathan being drunk.
I've noticed that the indicator that I think it seems to me that the shorthand in movies for being drunk is sweating harder than a hooker in church. I mean, seriously, I mean, every single person that is drunk in these movies is sweating, like, through, like, three suit coats.
Many, many films do,
yeah.
Yes.
The shorthand for being drunk is
The other
is
shorthand
sweating.
For being drunk is being happy all the time.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah.
So
interesting.
Yeah, that doesn't happen so much anymore, the happy drunk.
Happy drunk?
It's not really a thing.
In movies?
In movies.
Oh, okay, I was going to say, it's like, there are no happy drunks anymore.
No,
they're all gone.
They're all gone, yeah.
Yeah.
No, so this telling of Stingo, this story about Auschwitz actually serves as a really interesting non-sexual counterpoint to Stingo's failed date. Because they don't get together, Stingo and Sophie, at this point. But they're very close, and it's a very intimate story that she's telling him about arriving and about working in the camp and going to steal the radio, and the daughter of the commandant catching her,
yeah,
trying to steal the radio, and then the kids threatening to turn her in, but then she doesn't.
Yeah,
looking at her photo journal from Dachau when they were assigned to Dachau, and the kids were living there, and it was a much nicer camp
because it had a heated pool for the officers' kids.
Exactly. So
that's fucking weird.
It's all about perspective in that case. I mean, not excusing, just saying, you know, a kid is going to know what they know.
She's a Nazi.
Indeed. So when Nathan arrives home that evening, because Stingo uses this moment of intimacy between the two of them, Sophie and himself, to push the issue of, you know, we should maybe get together.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of thing. He doesn't say it directly, but he keeps trying to maneuver Sophie into a clinch, basically.
Uh-huh.
And she resists, and in an effort to find Nathan, she reveals to Stingo Nathan's obsession with hunting Nazis.
Yes.
Which is an interesting subplot that kind of goes nowhere.
Yeah. He's obsessed with them and that's it.
Yeah. And then it's then that really the balloon bursts about Nathan's job.
Yeah.
There's a scene where Nathan suggests that they're really close to this big breakthrough about some drug, and yeah, he buys clothes for everybody, and they're going to have a party. He comes home drunk, which is weird because he was just going back to the office, but he comes back, he's drunk.
It's a couple hours later.
They get into a fight.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. But then the next day or so, it's revealed to Stingo that Nathan is a paranoid schizophrenic.
Yeah.
Who is living free of the asylums, but
yeah,
has been in and out of them all his life.
Mm-hmm.
He was a genius child who was diagnosed at age, what, at age 10?
10 was paranoid schizophrenia.
And his brother actually describes him as the type of child everyone prepares to take credit for. Because he was so smart about everything. He was so... He said he mastered sciences, he mastered math.
Yeah, he was a genius.
Everybody wanted to be the person. Everybody was discussing what he was going to be in the future.
Yeah.
What he was going to do, what he was going to discover. And they all were preparing themselves to take credit for those discoveries.
Yeah, to take credit for the creating the child that... molding the child yeah. that caused those discoveries. They made those discoveries.
Yeah. So, from there, the story sort of unravels. Nathan is manic again.
Yeah,
he's threatening Stingo and Sophie with shooting them because he thinks that they're having an affair.
Yeah.
Which they're not, much to Stingo's chagrin. And, you know, it's strange. You would think that this sort of soap opera-ish feeling mm-hmm. in this story would sort of grate, but it doesn't. And I think it's a real tribute to the work who is the director? Alan Pakula.
Yeah.
Alan Pakula? Pakula. Pakula.
Oh, no.
Okay. writing the screenplay. Apparently, he took about 2 years.
Really?
To adapt the book to a screenplay.
That's pretty good.
And it's a really dense film. There's a lot of detail in it, and there's a lot of detail from the book.
There's a lot of details, and it's a long movie, too.
It's long, but it's paced. It's nicely paced.
It's paced really well.
So, to kind of sum it all up, Stingo and Sophie go on the lam. Instead of waiting around for Nathan to show up with a gun, they decide to hoof it down south. And on the way there, Stingo reveals that he would like to marry Sophie and live with her in this small town, on this farm that his father has inherited.
Yeah.
And that he can live on because he's running out of money, and he can write and do all that stuff. And at that moment, Sophie reveals to him what her true choice was.
Yeah.
And it is... I don't know, were you shocked?
The
choice was which child... is going to live.
Honestly,
the child's going to die.
Well, honestly, I really wasn't. I was a little surprised, but it wasn't like, this awful choice because, you know, I don't have kids.
Well, there's that, yeah, I suppose.
I don't have children. At least I hope I don't have children. I understand. Yeah, no, but it was a choice that, you know. It was Nazis, okay? I mean, it's just
they were gonna take both children.
Yeah.
They were gonna take both children.
Yeah.
And they said choose one.
Yeah.
And she couldn't choose, and she couldn't choose, and she couldn't choose, and they were coming over to take both children, and she chose
her daughter.
Her daughter.
In a spur of the moment, you know,
almost literally tossed the child into the arms of the guards.
Yeah. which was they never really went into why she chose her daughter over her son.
True.
So true. I don't really know what was the motivation. So I didn't know what the motivation was behind that. So I didn't really care. I mean, I literally found out that she had children. Like, I may not have been paying attention, but it was like, oh, she has children.
She revealed it in small ways.
Yeah.
Over the course of her flashbacks.
Yeah.
You know, her husband was revealed in the beginning of the second flashback.
Uh-huh.
In the middle of the second flashback, it was revealed
the children
that she had children.
On the train, yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, you move forward a little bit. And she had actually revealed that she had children before then. She had said, she had mentioned that she had had children.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it was just like, I didn't know anything about either one of the children. And as somebody who does not have kids, I'm not really attached
but
to...
But you can't make a value judgment based on what you know about one child over the other, really.
Yeah, that's true, but, you know
That doesn't make it any easier.
Right, but it's one of those things where it's like, I can't feel anything for anything I don't know about. I mean, you know, I didn't...
Right, the instant...
Right,
the
only thing I knew was their names.
That are in, are supposed to be engendered by, oh, this is a mother, these are her children.
Right.
Don't... Okay, I can see that.
But it's like, you know, as somebody who isn't, you know, affected by that because I don't know the experience of having children, you know, it's like, my children, I would do anything for them, blah, 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 blah. Don't get that yet because I don't have them. As such, you know, when they pull, you know, like the choose which child must die kind of thing, it's not very moving for me, so to speak.
Okay.
It's one of those things where it's like I understand. I mean, I get what they're doing.
Right.
And, you know, I understand that, you know, it's a very cruel, very awful thing, but it's Nazis, first of all. Nazis are assholes.
Yeah.
And second, you know, I'm pretty sure that they pulled this kind of shit, so it's it's one of those things where it's like, it doesn't really, I get it.
So not shocking.
Not shocking.
And
it's
not really
shocking to me. I mean, hell, they...
Pulling.
Yeah, it's not really emotionally pulling because they made him choose a kid. They also killed 6 million people, which was a point they made in the movie anyway.
Quite a bit.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where it's like, okay, cool. Nazis are evil. You've established something that everyone knows. Like I said while we were watching the movie. Ah, the Nazis. The only people where they actually put skulls on their uniforms to prove that they are evil from the start.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so,
So, to sort of wrap up the synopsis here, or the story in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Chock full of spoilers, as we might call it.
Yeah.
Sophie has revealed this information to, Stingo to essentially tell him, I cannot be
a mother
your
again.
Wife, and I cannot be a mother. She leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And the next time we see Sophie and Nathan, they're both dead.
They had ingested cyanide.
Yeah.
And they were both dead.
Yeah.
And that is, there's a small narration of while the main character Stingo is walking away, and then fade to credits.
Yeah, he talks about how his life had changed, and he was going to go back south because he couldn't live in the city anymore.
Yeah.
And that he had learned things.
Yep.
Did a little growing up.
Yeah.
So, what should we talk about now? Why is this movie here? To keep with we've talked about, dear podcast listeners, we've talked about a little bit more structure to the podcast because I've noticed in listening back that we've been kind of bouncing around.
Yeah.
Which may be something that appeals to people. I don't know. But, you know, let us know.
Please, for the love of God.
So, why is this movie on the list what is its appeal? What is it that you think? Because the thing about this list is that none of these films have actually had an explanation as to why they're on the list.
They're just on the
list. It's a complete and utter popularity contest.
Of course.
They asked the members of their organization to write down their top 100, or however they did it, and it was ranked by votes.
Uh-huh.
This one was number 91.
It probably doesn't hurt that it's a really good movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing about all these movies is that we have yet to...
But it's damn depressing.
It is damn depressing. You're right.
And there's layers and layers and layers of depression, which
that is
true. Guess actually adds to its appeal.
Exactly. It's just sad, piled on sad, piled on miserably.
As soon as you think this is as sad as it can get, they go in for another gut punch and they say, there you go, how about that?
Just when it could get any...
he got shot.
And and
her boyfriend's a schizophrenic.
You had enough? She had kids.
We ain't done. So she was a Nazi. She was a Nazi secretary.
Oh.
How about that?
She
had to walk through the mud in front of the people who were going to be gassed within a matter of days.
Oh, you think we're done? Oh, no.
Yeah.
Here's the other thing. She had to choose which kid had to die.
I know.
Anyway,
that's the kind of stuff we're talking about.
Yeah, it was just sad.
Layers upon layers upon layers. So as we sat there, crying and braiding each other's hair. All right, this movie gets a bad rap as it's a girl's film. It's a wimpy. It's a romantic. It's a romantic film.
This isn't romantic in the sense that...
There's nothing particularly romantic about this film.
Yeah.
There is a lot of desperate clawing in this film. There is a lot of adolescent reaching in this film. This is not a romantic film. I don't understand, personally, and maybe it's because when I saw it the first time, you know, I was 18, it was on video, I was dating, it was like, okay, so, and it's weepy, and it's a good movie to get close to somebody because you can just kind of gloss over a lot of the stuff in this film if you're not paying attention to it, but... There's some sexual energy, there's some charge to this film, but I don't get how people can classify this as a romantic film. Because this is not a date movie.
No, it is not.
At all.
It
may be a movie where you roll up in a blanket and you eat a bucket of ice cream.
not a pint, just a bucket.
And cry some more. You know, and think about this family that you haven't had yet. Or... I don't know, because because Kevin Kline, who was brilliant in this film.
He was fantastic.
And it's actually his second film.
Yeah.
It's billed as his first film because it was released first, but he had actually he was the Pirate King in the Pirates of Penzance.
Oh, really?
Before this, with Linda Ronstadt as the girl. But, so he did that film because he had been playing the Pirate King in the Pirates of Penzance on Broadway.
Yeah.
And
was he a Broadway actor?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
This was his second film.
Quote unquote first movie.
And then it was released first, so they got the introducing and they got to be able to say that. But he was brilliant.
Yeah.
And he was bug fuck nuts.
He was
crazy. And it wasn't when it was revealed what was going on with him and his character, there's like this sort of sense of like this tension. It's like the air being let out of a balloon, but it's a balloon of anticipation. Because the whole time you're watching him, there's something about what he's doing and how he's doing it and what he's saying. And he keeps showing up drunk and all this stuff. What in the hell is going to happen with this guy?
Yeah.
What's next?
Yeah.
And when it finally is like, oh, he really is crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. Now all of this stuff makes sense. He's not just a flighty individual who's being painted as this sort of artist, free spirit, whatever.
No, he's legitimately crazy.
He's actually mentally ill.
Yeah.
And at a time when there was no treatment.
Yeah.
For that kind of thing. He was self-medicating, apparently.
With
drinking
cocaine.
Lots of alcohol. And he was drinking, he was taking cocaine and...
Benzedrine, which is...
An amphetamine.
An amphetamine.
Because in 1947 it would have been an amphetamine. See, that's what I'm talking about.
All right.
All right, so it was an amphetamine.
Okay.
Kind of like meth, but not.
Yeah.
Well, very similar to
probably a couple more methyl groups than methamphetamine.
Possibly.
Anyway.
Chemistry.
Chemistry. Chemistry.
Anyway, so this movie also, I think this movie, from a technical standpoint, should be on the list because of its adaptation.
Yes.
Because of the dense, usually when you adapt a book, you lose a lot of the subplots, you lose a lot of the minor things, and there's a lot of detail in this film that makes it feel like, and I haven't read the book, so I don't know every nook and cranny, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like there's a lot of things in the film that were in the book, and they were the kind of things that you would say in a normal, we could leave that out. You know,
yeah.
The whole, oh, he's a Nazi hunter too, or he wants to find all the Nazis that got away.
Yeah.
You know, why? Because his girlfriend's a Nazi?
Because he's a Jew.
His girlfriend's a Nazi. Oi. Oh, there was an important reveal.
He was a Jew?
No, he's a Jew, but no. Her father.
Oh, yeah.
Who in the first flashback is portrayed as this saintly man who was a university person and is taken away by the Nazis to be killed. In the second flashback, it's revealed he was a Nazi sympathizer.
Yeah.
Him up because they rounded all the academics up.
Yeah.
Not because of his politics.
Yeah.
And
they went in and they did a sweep of the academia. They didn't bother to stop to check for politics.
Right. So that was an interesting, like, whoa, okay.
Nice.
You know, so there's all this detail and all this stuff, and it really goes to show that you can adapt a book and you can make a movie that is a good adaptation of a book, that is a page for page or line for line, whatever.
Yeah.
You can do it. It's not always successful.
Yeah.
But it can work. You know?
Nice.
It's one of these that you don't have to go, well, it's a different medium.
What? No.
Where you can say, well, that was the book and this is the movie, and they're both good.
Yeah.
But the book had more detail and this didn't have as much because, well, it's a movie. You know, that kind of thing. This is not one of those movies. This actually works. There's several that you can say, man, they should have cut out about half of that junk because that movie was way too long.
Yeah.
But it's not confusing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. It's so woven together that all the storylines make sense, all the little details, everything.
Yeah.
It just works. It was really good.
Yeah.
Something else, though, that actually kind of grated on me a little bit, and I don't know at this point whether this was just movies that were made in this era.
Yeah.
Or movies about this era. Movies that were made at this time about that era. As another film that came out at about the same time was A Christmas Story.
Go on.
Now tell me two things about this movie and about A Christmas Story that are similar.
They both take place in the late 40s to early 50s.
Correct. And? It's actually a look of, I will make a guess, it's the look of the movie. There's this sort of gauzy, nostalgic, slightly blurry, there's no deep focus to it, there's this slightly blurry cheesecloth kind of feel, like you're shooting through and you get this sort of glow.
Yeah.
That this movie, and I don't know whether it was intentional or whether it was just that's the lighting that they were using at this particular time. I think with Christmas Story, it was intentional that you wanted to have a warm, nostalgic glow to the film.
Yeah. Sophie's Choice?
Well, if it's about the idyllic times.
Yeah.
About when they're laughing and dancing and happy, yes. Because that glow wasn't on the scenes in the concentration camp.
True.
Except when they were in the garden.
Yeah.
When she walked through that garden, everything was bright color. Because she went from the mud
and the
walking
the gray.
Across, and it was all gray, and the colors were just washed out. Almost black and white. Almost Schindler's List black and white.
Yeah, that...
Maybe not quite that
stark. It caught me. It was like, oh, wait.
But then all of a sudden, they open the door, and it's like walking into Oz.
Yeah.
And there's like this green grass, and the flowers, and the kids' uniforms, and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they go back into the... house and everything gray again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess it's possible that I'm filling those colors in my head, but there was a stark contrast between where they were and where she went.
Yeah.
Where she was in the mud and where she came into the garden.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed to me that there was color there.
In that
garden.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, there was definitely, it was definitely Phew. A lot
but not
cleaner.
As much color, but not as much color as the present.
Yeah.
Where, you know, 1947, yeah. where the house is pink, and the skies are blue, and the sun is bright, and the beach is warm.
Yeah.
And the clothes are brightly colored, and they're having a good time.
Yeah.
And that's all, this. So that makes sense that this is sort of like, oh, this should remind us of these good times.
Yeah, the times when
there's
things
a stark
yeah,
reality.
Yeah, when times are better.
Yeah. So, just wanted to get that in there. So, okay, so we have, it's a good adaptation, or it feels like it should be noted as a good adaptation. It's a good movie.
Oh, yeah.
Bears repeated viewings?
Only if you want to feel really sad. Really.
If you want to get your sad on.
If you just want to.
Sophie's Choice.
If you just
want to
feel sad. Not even cry or feel, you know, depressed
That's
or anything.
That's true. That
if you just want to be sad.
That didn't make me want to cry. It
yeah.
There are ways to do that. The first 8 minutes of Up.
Oh!
That's a good way to get me. That's
the, la-
get,
the last.
That gets me every time.
The last 10 minutes of Toy Story 3, another Pixar movie.
That's pretty good. That's
yeah,
pretty good. And it's interesting that we're going to Pixar movies.
Well,
as
Pixar has gotten really
or Christmas Story.
Our Christmas Story
for a comparison yeah. to Sophie's Choice.
I'm sorry, but Pixar. I'm just gonna go off on a slight tangent here. Pixar has gotten really fucking dark in the last couple of years.
Good for them.
Yeah, good
for
them.
They should.
Yeah.
It should be dark.
It got real dark, and
it's about growing up.
I know it's about growing up, but still. Okay. But in Up, a lot of people don't realize this. Like, I asked people. Some people don't realize this. The wife had a miscarriage.
Yeah.
She lost the baby.
Uh-huh.
And it was just...
Well, that's because it gets breezed over because she dies.
I know she dies, but it was still,
Later.
Like, one of those things where it's like...
Yep.
Holy shit.
Yep.
And then, of course, you know, the growing up thing of Andy and all
right.
that stuff. It's all
very
sad. If they make a Toy Story 4, I will be pissed off. Because they closed that fucking door.
Yes.
It is
so,
closed, locked, and shredded.
So back to the... Oh, nice. Yeah. Reference to Monsters, Inc.
What's up?
Okay.
Anyway.
So back to Sophie's Choice and the Nazis.
The Nazis.
Yeah. Billowing black smoke.
Yes. Everywhere.
That was an interesting touch. At Auschwitz and their depiction of it. So apparently, Kevin Klein was the first choice for Nathan.
Is that
oh,
right?
Oh no, actually, he wasn't. He was the first one it was actually offered to.
Oh yeah.
After he auditioned.
Oh.
They also thought about giving the part to Robert De Niro, Al Pacino.
Al Pacino?
Yes.
No.
And a bunch of other people. But it was never offered to anyone. When the author wrote the book, William Steyer, I hope I'm getting that name right, I didn't write it down. When he was writing the book, he wrote it with Ursula Andress in mind.
Ursula Andress?
Yes, which kind of gives more, it's more of a, oh, this is when he wrote the book, not a, I was writing this in the 80s, and it turned out that I was thinking of a 60s actress.
Ah.
I think it was being written when that would have been an interesting choice for an actress.
Uh-huh.
Bette Midler. Oh, excuse me, no, not Bette Midler. Barbara Streisand apparently was on the list for that film as well.
I don't know who that is.
She's a singer. She was doing some movies. She did some movies through the 70s.
Oh, that's awfully nice.
Yeah. That would have been an interesting choice.
Mm-hmm.
But Meryl Streep apparently got the role and she won an Oscar for it.
Really?
She learned Polish.
I saw. She spoke fluent Polish for a lot of the movie.
Well, she learned to speak Polish for 3 months. So I don't know if she learned Polish, you know. But then she learned her lines. She wanted to get the accent for speaking English with a Polish accent.
Yeah.
So she learned some Polish, and then she learned her lines as a Polish speaker trying to speak English, and she used a dialect coach to get those words right.
Mm-hmm.
She picked up some German.
Nice.
For the film as well. And it's that kind of dedication, you know?
Yeah.
That makes movies, it makes actresses and actors really interesting to watch when they're willing to do things like that, that, you know, go a little bit beyond, because she could have easily have just passed off a Russian accent.
Oh, yeah.
For the film, and we probably would have been, that's fine. But, you know, when you know Polish people,
yeah,
who speak English, and she sounds like them,
yeah,
and you go, wow, that sounds like, you know, insert name of person that you know who's Polish,
yeah,
who speaks English and speaks just like that, and the little nuances, the way that they pronounce I's and E's in words,
yeah,
that don't usually have them in English. They don't have a pronunciation to them.
Nah.
They pronounce them anyway, and it sells it.
Yeah.
And
well, the interesting thing about German and Polish and all that stuff is they pronounce every letter.
They do indeed, and and it translates over in English. Now,
yeah.
There was one other thing. Peter McNichol, who plays Stingo,
mm-hmm.
Is an interesting character actor. I would say most of our audience is probably going to know him from Numbers. He was one of the mathematicians. He was the math professor.
Oh, the
in Numbers.
I
think that was. I didn't watch it very much.
Neither did I.
He was on Ally McBeal for a while. One of the lawyers on that show. Right before he did this movie, he did a little movie that is actually one of my favorites to this day, called Dragon Slayer.
Oh yes.
And
Erland.
I might not go so far as to put that one up against, say, a Return of the King or, you know, something that has some dragons in it. But damn it, that was a good movie. And he was good in it. And it represented a time when Disney was trying to go a little darker, to be a little bit more adult. And they quickly went away from that after Black Hole tanked. But
Black Hole?
The Black Hole, yeah. It's a movie about a black hole.
That sounds...
Nothing escapes from it. Not even light. How could they expect the audiences to get out of there? Really?
Well, they never went in. That's how.
Sucked the good time right out of them. So, another digression. But, you know, Kevin Kline went from this movie to do other films that were very good.
Yeah.
And Meryl Streep, of course. This wasn't her, by any means, her first film. And it wasn't even her first... It was her first... I want to say it was her first Oscar win, but I'm not sure about that.
Well,
it was not her first nomination.
Yeah.
She got a nomination for The Deer Hunter, so, which I think is also on the list. So it's basically, at its core, it's a three-person, you know, it's a three-person show.
Yeah.
These three actors are almost literally in a vacuum.
Yeah.
There's a couple of other minor characters that come in and out and stuff, you know, it's really striking how affected, like I said, though, not crying, not, you know, just, it's upsetting.
Yeah.
That this movie has these layers, and, you know, you make jokes about, oh, you know, Sophie's Choice, it's a tearjerker, whatever.
Nah.
It's not. It's a sit up and make you cringe at the kind of shit that humans used to do to each other. And
still do.
Still do, and are capable of doing. And not just the Nazis. Not just the Nazis.
Yeah.
Nathan is, as it turns out, crazy, but a drug addict, an alcoholic, abusive. Sophie is
an enabler.
And abused, and has the classic, and has many of the symptoms of PTSD
and daddy issues.
And at a time when this didn't, you know, when this movie came out, PTSD was kind of a thing.
Yeah,
but it was one of those, we're looking askance at it. We're going to look through our fingers at it, mm-hmm. and say, we don't think so.
Yeah,
you know, because and certainly not for survivors of abuse or survivors of you know, torture or terror like this, that it was just at that point the new word for shell shocked, the new word for battle fatigue, new word for you know, so that aspect of the film didn't really get explored, but there's some really serious therapy that goes on in this film, and it's interesting that what was her name again? Leslie Lapidus is brought in to say, "I've been psychoanalyzed."
Yeah,
you know, and I'm in therapy, and I like the fuck.
Yeah,
but there's that little pinprick of just like, boink, we just said psychoanalyze, and then you get three sessions of Sophie talking to, essentially, a therapist,
uh-huh.
about her experiences and reliving them and going through the trauma again and how that affects her and how that affects Nathan and how it affects Stingo in this thing. It's pretty affecting.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. And, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's that. So if you agree with anything we've said, drop us a line. If you disagree, same thing. Drop us a line. We're at 100ofsomething@gmail.com. That's 100ofsomething@gmail.com. I'm on the Twitter box at Mr. Bowen. And the Fro over there, he's @_Fro. We'd love to hear from you, so, you know, blow it up. Next week, we have movie number 90, which is Swing Time.
Oh, goody.
Starring Fred Astaire. So there's going to be some dancing.
Woo!
There's going to be some singing. There's going to be some laughing. And it's going to be in black and white.
Oh, of course it is.
Yeah. So we'll see y'all next week.